It's time for another edition of San Luis Valley Voices, a production of SL Voices, your voice in the San Luis Valley. Without further ado, enjoy the program.
Sponsorship of this podcast was provided by
Fay Moon Wolf Designs at 122 Adams Street in Monta Vista is a delightful gallery and gift shop where you'll be greeted with soft, melodious, indigenous music as you browse their extensive and eclectic offerings. Just a glance at their display windows shows this shop is fascinating. Crow Wolf and Katie specialize in custom handmade moccasins with original burnt accents making each pair one of a kind. Moccasins range in size from tiny baby feet to adult, made with authentic techniques passed down through generations of talented native craftsmen. Each piece of jewelry, also handmade, is unique and made with care and vision. Native American and local artwork make this gallery and gift shop like nothing else in the San Luis Valley. Katie is an accomplished photographer, and her photography graces the walls and fascinates visitors at Fay Moon Wolf Designs. But there is so much more. Lovely aromatic candles handmade with non-toxic scents, rustic antler furniture, handmade leather pouches of all sizes, beautiful handcrafted gift cards, books for both children and adults, intricately carved wood pieces, and so much more. Everything at Fay Moon Wolf Designs is eco-friendly or consciously made with purpose in mind. There are beautiful dolls and other toys which support non-bullying organizations. There are toys that inspire imagination and children's books that open the doors for lively conversations. Fay Moon Wolf Designs is located at 122 Adams Street in downtown Monta Vista, Colorado, next to Nino's. More than a shop, it's an entrance into culture, learning, awe-inspiring artwork, where you'll love to shop in a welcoming and peaceful environment. Crow Wolf and Katie truly appreciate every person that walks through their doors. You can also visit their website at faymoonwolfdesigns.com. That's faemoonwolfdesigns.com. Or call them at 719-859-2656. That's 719-859-2656. Fay Moon Wolf Designs, inspired by Mother Earth.
Christopher O'Brien spent over a decade in the San Luis Valley learning about and investigating over 1,000 paranormal events, working with law enforcement, former military, ranchers, and an extensive network of sky watchers. He documented what may have been the most intense wave of unexplained activity ever seen in a single region of North America. That region, located in south central Colorado and north central New Mexico, is known as the San Luis Valley. His time, effort, and experiences resulted in a Mysterious Valley book trilogy and includes The Mysterious Valley, Enter the Valley, and Secrets of the Mysterious Valley, one of the largest databases of unusual activity in a single geographic region, is a direct result of his field investigations of UFO reports, unexplained livestock deaths, haunted sites, Native American legends, cryptozoology, and folklore found in the world's largest alpine valley. This database is available for access by all on his website, ourstrangeplanet.com. Christopher O'Brien was kind enough to spend an entire day with SL Voices to tell his stories, as well as stories shared with him by various people in the San Luis Valley. We gladly present this multi-part podcast series to our audience to inform, entertain, and enlighten. Enjoy!
I'm Adam. We're here with Martha and talking with researcher Christopher O'Brien about a whole wide range of things. Christopher, you left us in the last podcast hanging about something running around a yard and a very scared dog.
And I just want to let you know that I haven't let my dogs out at night since you told us that. And I'm a little scared, so I need you to finish that one up and tell me everything's okay.
Well, again, just to recap, the town police chief, Joe Taylor, got a call from his nephew. And she, or niece, she had a dog, a big dog, a Rottweiler, if I remember. And she put it outside the fence that I think it was a 6-foot fence. And she heard something big and real heavy run by her house. not once, but twice. And she heard her dog yelp. And so she went outside, and there the dog was sitting there shaking like a leaf inside the fence. Now, there's no way that the dog could have gotten in there. So she assumed that whatever it was threw the dog over the fence. And we're talking a big dog here now. So she brought the dog in and was disconcerted by the whole thing. And she hadn't called her uncle or anything or her nephew yet at this point. And the next morning, she went out for her customary walk, and it was very, very cold. And she lived just by the Conejos River. And she went down, and right on the other side of the river, she saw huge tracks in the snow, two sets of them, barefoot humanoid tracks that were coming down from the little mesa top that's on the other side of the river. So she was able to follow these tracks, backtrack, and follow them from where they came from up the hill, the side of the bank that went down to the river. She followed them up, and then she was able to trace them for several hundred yards over a variety of terrain. At this point, she thinks that the tracks were laid down the prior day. It had been fairly hot in the sun, so there had been some melt, and some of the tracks were actually pressed into the ground. She said, obviously, they were very, very heavy. I forget what the dimensions were. I think one was 14, the other was 18 inches, and they were walking side by side, and the larger set of tracks also had drops of blood that were dripping on the snow and on the ground intermittently along the trackway. Well, she was very, very impressed with this, obviously, and she put two and two together and figured out that it was probably some Bigfoot that had tossed her dog over the fence. So she called her nephew. He called his dad. They both came down with a video camera, and they videotaped the tracks. So this is a pretty good report. Two law enforcement officials videotaping what appeared to be humanoid tracks in the dead of winter in the San Luis Valley, walking barefoot for hundreds of yards. That's pretty good, compelling evidence. They called me and had me come down later on. By then, the tracks were pretty much gone because of the weather and stuff. They didn't call me right away. And they took some of the blood and they had it tested, and it came back as elk blood. And interestingly enough, other reports started to filter in at the end of that December period into January. And there was about a week to 10-day period where there were seven reports of Bigfoot, including one at Fox Creek. A mother and son were driving at night. They saw this thing standing in the road. It had tall ears, like bat ears. When they got pretty close and slowed down, it dropped down on all fours and ran away like a dog. That's an interesting one. There was another report of a hunter observing through a spotting scope two Bigfoot, one large one, one smaller one, that appeared to be stalking a herd of elk right on the northern side of San Antonio Peak. There was another report of a snowplow driver for the county was plowing the 285 down to the border there. He claimed a Bigfoot ran out in front of his snowplow and he hit it, knocked it down, it ran off. When he got back to the garage, he was pretty excited and he told the guys about it. And there was a dent in the snowplow, according to the to the story. I never did confirm that one. So that's kind of an apocryphal story. I find it very interesting that we should have all these Bigfoot reports clustered together in the dead of winter, just before a very, I think, noteworthy UFO wave. On January 12th, a couple of weeks later, we had the infamous NORAD event when NORAD called the Rio Grande County Sheriff to report a huge fire that was on the side of Greeny and told them to exhaust all efforts to find the fire. They flew search and rescue personnel. They had ground teams. And then as they were nearing the location, they were given long lat in minutes, hours, and seconds GPS coordinates. And when they were getting near, then they got another call saying, no, it's 20 miles to the west. And so they thought this was kind of weird, but they followed instructions and they went to the west and didn't find anything. And we had all sorts of strange reports of military activity at the site of the original coordinates that day and the following days. So that was one of the dark horse UFO events in the whole country in 1995, I think. So as far as Bigfoot goes, I wrote a chapter in the Journal of Sasquatch Studies, Volume 2, about Southern Colorado, Northern New Mexico Bigfoot reports. And much to my surprise, there's been quite a number of them over the years, close to 100, which kind of surprised me. I wasn't aware that there were so many going back a number of decades. It seems like the Conejos Canyon area is probably the epicenter of Bigfoot activity in the San Juan, southern San Juans. And during the winter, they're out towards the mouth of the river. And then during the summer, they go into the higher elevations. They go up to the north, up the canyon, up towards the old town of Jasper up there and the lake. And quite a number of sightings from there. We've had sightings just below the border in Costilla Canyon. We've had sightings between there and Wild Horse Mesa. There's been what one witness claimed is a family of Bigfoot that's kind of lurking around the North Crestone Creek area. they're passing through in the spring and then back the other way in the fall. There's been a couple of supposed encounters up there. Those are more rumors than actual reports. And we have some reports over from the La Vida Pass area, some reports from Blanca. So Bigfoot is something that I'm very interested in. And, you know, I have, like I said, been involved in one that had physical evidence. So it's kind of hard to hoax.
Well, I understand, too, that there have been an increase in sightings here just recently.
Yes, there has been. I've been sent some photographs, which are on the UFODAP site. Last September, there was a number of good sighting reports. The end of August, all the way through September, we had reports of lights over Blanca. That tends to be the precursor. That and the cheap fireworks tend to be precursor events. I think if you see lights over Blanca, that means that there's going to be activity. At least that's what the pattern suggests based on past activity and waves. There's been silver orbs being seen. There's been a number of sightings over between Del Norte and Creed around the South Fork and the canyon up there. There's been some reports down around the border area. There's been a couple of reports from Crestone. So it did seem like this fall we had an upsurge in activity. It tends to be most predominant in the fall and spring is when we have most of our activity, with some activity summer being a close third, and then, of course, the wintertime being when we have normally the least amount of activity in the area. I think a lot of that is just how many people are outdoors. Obviously, during the spring, summer, and fall, you're going to have more people outdoors than you do during the wintertime. But some of the most compelling events have happened in the winter, so there's no hard, steadfast rule about that.
There are a lot of indigenous people in the valley, and that's evident by many of the names of the passes and the trails and the towns. We had a question sent to us, and I'm just going to read it to you as it's written in the interest of authenticity. I would love to know Christopher O'Brien's opinion on the Native American involvement with the underground so-called ant beings. They were depicted in some of their cave drawings, and the stories say that the extraterrestrials that had been stationed here underneath the sand dunes were watching them take care of the land and were so impressed by their compassion for the earth and the spirit that they offered to take them underneath the ground to save them from the last great deluge or flood. They supposedly then brought them back after the deluge and tried to expand out from the valley and rebuild their population. Now, some Native Americans still share this story and claim to be very connected with these people slash beings still. Please expand on this if possible.
That's a very good question, and it's an area of research that I am particularly fond of. Just before I start with the answer, let me say that I'm not Native American, so anything that I say is a nosy white boy with a black cowboy hat's opinion. Again, that's something that you should temper my response with that knowledge. I have had the good fortune to befriend a number of Native American elders. The first one that really was quite impressive to me, and I did establish quite a fairly close relationship with Grandfather Martin Gushri Osomo of the Hopi. He was the last Sacred Fire Clan tablet holder. The most sacred artifact in the Hopi tradition is the prophecy tablet that was given the Hopi by Creator with the corner broken off. Now, I have to digress a little bit here. The Hopi are the primordial Aboriginal people of North America. They were here before all the other Native American cultures evolved and migrated here and evolved. They are the first, and close on their heels, the Zuni would be their little brothers. All other Native Americans came afterwards. So what you're describing with the myth or the story of the ant people is a Hopi story that is centered in the Little Colorado River area, just upstream from the main confluence with the Colorado in Grand Canyon. And that's called the Sipapu. And there's a actual formation on the side of the river there that looks like a giant ant hill. It's domed and it has a hole on the top, and the hole is filled with water. When the water drains out, that's a sign, one of a number of signs, to the people, which is what Hopi means. That means the people. We're all Hopi, according to the Hopi. Some of us are more Hopi than others, and some of us are Ka Hopi, or false Hopi. And when these particular signs are seen, the Hopi are then told that it's time for the earth to cleanse itself, and they are told to go to the Sipapu, which is quite difficult to get to, I might add. You have to go down Salt River Canyon or Little Colorado River Gorge is not an easy place to hike around in. But you're supposed to go there, and then you go underground, and that's where the great underground city is located. It was rediscovered by a prospector kind of a legend at this point. In 1909, the Smithsonian allegedly came and cleaned out the front part of the complex. And they estimated if the complex, they didn't investigate the whole thing because once they got back into the backside, towards the backside of the underground city, they were overpowered with the smell of reptiles. So they didn't want to go any further. They said if it went all the way around, it kind of resembles Burning Man with the big circular arrangement with the passageways coming off the spokes of a wheel. And they said that it could house between 50 and 60,000 people under there. Well, the Hopi are the ones that originated the myth of the Ant People. The Ant People supposedly live underground. They're not aliens. They're endemic to this planet. They're native to this planet. But they do live underground. And when the people go underground to be protected during earth changes, then the Ant People do keep them alive. And that's why the ants have such skinny waists, because they give all their food to the people, hence the name Ant People. I have seen very, very interesting drawings and pictographs of the Ant People, and they are very strange looking. They have multiple arms. And then, as your questioner pointed out, you know, when the Earth has cleansed itself and it's safe to go back up to the surface, the Ant People allow the people to go back up, and then they're divided up into clans, and they're sent off in the four directions to repopulate the Western world. Now, this particular story has spread from the original Hopi version. It has spread to the Pueblos. The Pueblos are Hopi that went to the rivers when the great drought happened in 1260, 1280, 1300, and all the cliff dwellings, water sources dried up. Of course, the Indians needed water, so they went to the Rio Grande, the San Juan, and to various rivers and resettled there. Now we have 22 Pueblos that are spread up and down the Rio Grande, all the way up to the Taos Pueblo. And the Tiwa have very similar traditions, as all Pueblo people do, to the Hopi original emergence myth. Now, the Hopi say that we're in the fourth world, and as your questioner pointed out, the end of the third world was the Great Flood, which happened about 12 to 13,000 years ago, give or take 1,000 years or so. And then the one before that was destroyed by ice, and the one before that by fire. We are at the end of the fourth world. I would not be surprised if I saw a news report saying all of a sudden a bunch of campers and RVs and teepees showed up at the edge of the rim of the canyon there for people waiting to go underground, because I'll tell you, the way things are going, Mother Earth may want to cleanse everything here in the not-too-distant future. So that's a really good question. Again, I don't think that these ant people are aliens. I think that if they do exist, that they're subterranean life forms. I don't think they're the only subterranean life forms either. Of course, the jury's still out on all that. I do have some pretty tantalizing circumstantial evidence that we have an ancient underground tunnel system that's been rediscovered by, for instance, the mining operation in Los Alamos. When they were expanding the national lab underground, allegedly some miners broke into an ancient underground tunnel system that was at least, they said, 10,000 years old. So there's a lot of interesting things going on beneath our feet. And when we sent up, I think it's called Dumpster, which is a satellite system that's able to penetrate the Earth and map negative spaces in the Earth's crust. First place they mapped was the Giza Plateau. The second place they mapped was the Yucatan. And the third place they mapped was the Southern Rockies. I know the government and the military, I just suspect that they're very interested in what's going on underground, but I don't think that there are alien bases underground with vats of stewed human and cow body parts and some of the crazy stories that you hear. I have a hard time believing any of that. But I do think that, let's put it this way, when people say keep your eyes to the sky, that reminds me to keep my ear to the ground.
Good advice. So, as I understand it, cryptozoology is kind of the study of all of this, Bigfoot, Native American legends, Loch Ness, and whatnot. It seems that the mainstream scientific community considers a lot of this pseudoscience, but this seems to be changing at this point. What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, it is, actually. It is changing. Jeffrey Meldrum is a tenured professor in hominid studies. His actual area of expertise is footprints and trace evidence of hominids. He has been converted. He really does feel that there is an undiscovered primate that has managed to slip through the cracks of definition and actual discovery in North America. He is an example of a growing number of scientists and academics that are becoming more and more convinced that we do have undiscovered animals in our midst. I mean, they discovered an undefined species of deer in Vietnam just a number of years ago. I mean, a large mammal had managed to escape detection all the way up until the 2010s. And I find that very intriguing. they discover new species every month. And they have only, they've barely investigated 2% of the world's oceans, which are 3/4 of the surface area of the planet. So I think there's a lot of hubris in the academic community that's slowly starting to change. I think with the advent of good diagnostic technology, more and more trace evidence, as in footprints, some blob squatches, as some people like to call the photographs and footage of Sasquatch. A lot of it is just the play of light and shadow in trees. Pareidolia, I think, is the actual term for ascribing meaning to chaos, chaotic photographs and stuff. I think that, you know, now that we have really good diagnostic equipment, someone's going to come up with some hair. Someone's going to come up with a sample of feces. Someone is going to come up with possibly the remains of a creature that's going to be able to be tested. And we will have genetic data that won't conform to known genetic data. And so I think at some point the data is going to overwhelm the mystery. And we have, you know, ourselves proof of something out there. The Bigfoot reports have been reported in 48 of 50 states. And most people don't know that. I mean, they've had Bigfoot reports in Nebraska, Kansas, Iowa, all over the South, all over the Northeast. Heck, we had a Bigfoot report near me here just a month or two ago here in upstate New York. These creatures, I think, are paraphysical. We've had interesting trackways that begin and end inexplicably with no tracks approaching and no tracks leaving, maybe 4 or 5 prints. They've been seen blinking in and out. They may have the ability to teleport based on some reports. I think the jury's out on their capabilities. I have a feeling that they are not only a undiscovered flesh and blood animal, but there is something paraphysical about them. That's my own opinion. And the San Luis Valley would be a perfect place in the mountains during the warmer months for these things to be tramping around in, you know, in their kind of high mountain paradise.
Okay, I have another of our followers' questions for you. And again, I'm going to read it as it's written, just for authenticity. This is from Steve, and he says, question, is there any information on the upcoming event involving Palladians, walk-ins, and the Trilat? Economic ramifications locally and globally?
The Trilat, he means what, the Trilateral Commission or something?
I assume so.
I'm not a big fan of channeled information. I do think that there is something to channeling. But when it comes to channeling aliens, I have a real hard time with that. I don't know of any corroborating or evidentiary information that says that there's anything like Palladians, that there's anything like Lyrans or Draconians or Zeta Reticuli aliens. I think a lot of this is the stuff of popular culture and new myth. I think that a lot of these people that promote this type of science fiction are charlatans. They're in it for notoriety. They're in it for fame and fortune. I could name some names to stay away from. Corey Good, Laura Eisenhower, Andrew Bisaggio, much of the information of David Wilcock, Pete Peterson, Dan Burrish. These people are disinformation at best, disinformation agents at worst, downright confabulators. They seem to come along about every couple years, and they piggyback their information on top of the existing narrative. They fill in blanks, like the Serpo story of the 13 astronauts sent to another planet. I mean, some of it just gets so ridiculous. I stick with the powers of diagnostic science. I stick to what the evidence and the data would suggest. Any of these fairy tale scenarios needs to have some evidence to back it up. Emery Smith, who's allegedly autopsied 3,000 aliens. Well, let me see your DD-214. Let me see your separation agreement with the military. Let me see, an example of your bona fides that you actually were a doctor, let's say. Let me see your medical degree. Whenever you ask for this stuff, the subject always gets changed. No one ever comes up with the goods to bolster their claims. I've been quite outspoken about this, and a lot of people don't like me for it. They want to believe so bad that if they hear something that conforms to the fantasies that they have about these subjects, then they believe it lock, stock, and barrel. You ask them why, they say, well, I intuitively feel that it's real. Well, I intuitively feel that these things are not real. So, I beg to differ. I'm one of the few people that's willing to point at these emperors on parade and run up, kick them in the shins, and ask who their tailor is. I'm just done and sick and tired of the BS that's out there in this field. it gives people like me who are really trying to do a proper job, use the power of diagnostic science, use real powers of analysis and evidentiary work. I just have no time for these scenarios. And I'm sorry about that, but you're asking the wrong guy. I have no idea. I've never heard of any of that except for the Trilateral Commission. I mean, if anything's wrong in the world, the Bilderbergers, the Trilateralists, and the, what are the other groups? The Bohemian Grove Bunch are running the world. And because I say it, people say that I'm a CIA agent, I'm a disinformation agent. People even say that I'm a reptilian, that I'm here to run interference and all this. It's like, man, these people need lives. Either that or get out of your mom's basement and freaking grow up.
So just for funsies here, some people have never heard of the Trilateral Commission. What is that?
The Trilateral Commission is just a group of influential rich guys that have a hard enough time, you know, deciding where to meet, let alone what the agenda is. You know, I had the, I guess, good fortune to be introduced to Lawrence Rockefeller, and I just coincidentally was able to spend 2 days one-on-one with him. And I asked him a lot of questions about the Council of Foreign Relations, the World Bank, Rockefeller's funding selective breeding and eugenics. I asked him some tough questions. I think he was very upfront with me, and he told me, look, you know, if you think that we can even get our schedules arranged to meet and then agree to where to meet and agree what our agenda is, alone agree on how we're going to run the world, he says, it doesn't work that way. Sure, there's undue influence by the big banks and by the big moneyed interests in the world, the World Bank, the IMF, organizations like that, which the Trilateral Commission is one of them, the same as the Bilderbergers. Rich old guys that get together and decide, you know, a few things, who they're going to support for elections, that sort of thing. I think they have a lot less influence than people would like to believe. One thing I did, I almost killed Rockefeller, literally. Well, should we wait for my cliffhanger?
Let's not leave a cliffhanger with the I almost killed Rockefeller. Let's not do that.
This is a great story. You can believe this if you want. I spent 2 days with the guy. I was very fortunate to meet him. Anna Strong called me up one day and says, I don't care what you're doing. It's not as important as what's going on over here. Gather up your research and get over here right away. And so I went, oh, man, I'd never gotten a call like that from Hannah before. Of course, Hannah Strong is the widow of the ex-Undersecretary General of the UN for the Environment, Maurice Strong. They're the ones that gave all the unbroken spiritual lineages there in Crestone 40 acres to build retreat centers and monasteries and healing centers and the like. And Hannah lived a couple houses over from me. So she called me up and I went over there. And as I was climbing up on her porch there, Dr. John Mack left. And I thought, oh, man, I blew it. I could have spent time with Harvard psychologist who was bucking the system to investigate abductions. I always wanted to meet him. So he was leaving to go to the airport. And Hannah says, oh, no. And I said, oh, man, I'm so bummed I didn't meet him. And she says, no, 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 come on in. And I walk in. There's Lawrence Rockefeller standing there. And, of course, I instantly knew who he was. And I just, whoa, you know, kind of put me back. Never met a billionaire before. So anyway, we sat down and just the two of us, we started talking. And he quizzed me on my work and asked me what I thought of particular researchers that he had been funding. Stephen Greer, Colin Andrews, John Mack. And I was very forthright and told him what I thought, which we won't get into here. And he says, oh, I'm glad you said that. I think that too, you know. So I wasn't telling him anything he didn't know. So anyway, we talked and talked. And then, you know, we had dinner and then we talked some more. And finally, it was time for him to call it an evening. But he said, could you come back tomorrow? And I said, yeah, sure. I'd love to. So I came back the next morning and I had the whole day with him. And we covered everything, you know, the mutilations, the UFO stuff, science, cosmology. I found out he had a, you know, a master's in philosophy from Princeton, which not many people know. And, you know, we had a great time. We ended up outside in the backyard with all of Hannah's grandkids running around and stuff. And we were sitting there and we kind of ran out of paranormal things to talk about. So this is when I started asking him all questions about what's it like to run the world and all this. And he was just laughing, saying, man, people just got the wrong idea. They don't understand. And I said, well, there's this new thing called the internet. You know, I do really getting into it and doing a lot of research on it and stuff. And it seems like every time I see mention of your little brother, David, people think he's the Antichrist. And he started laughing. He's, oh, 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 oh. And he couldn't stop. And he started to turn blue and choke. I mean, the guy was 89 years old and he really was in distress. And I was waving at his handlers, come on out here. And we gave him a glass of water. They took him in. They laid him down. He was turning blue from laughing. He couldn't stop. And they said, Mr. O'Brien, your weekend with Mr. Rockefeller is over. Take a hike, basically. They were not happy. I went home and I told Isidore, oh my God, I think I just killed Lawrence Rockefeller with a joke. I was horrified. And of course, Hannah was not happy. He left without her being able to talk to him about some things she wanted to talk about. And so I was like, oh my God, I blew it. A couple days later, there was a knock on the door and it was a hand-delivered fatty check from from Rockefeller. And he went on for the next 2 years and funded my research. So I didn't tell anybody that for years because I didn't want them to think I was some cutout from some agency or something, which I'm not. I've never worked for the government. I don't work for the government. I would never work for the government, even if they asked me. I'm an unpaid asset. I mean, all my data is open for anybody that wants it. It's all there for everybody. I don't have any secrets. Therefore, they don't have any reason to think that I do. So, you know, either you have really high visibility or no visibility is the only way you keep safe in this field. It's not the aliens that I'm worried about. It's the people.
But he never did answer your question, did he?
No, he never did. He never did. He just started laughing and he couldn't stop.
So the world may never know if his little brother is the Antichrist or not.
Christopher, we've got a note here to ask you about Chupacabra. And we've obviously never seen one. What can you tell us about the Chupacabra? And have there ever been any reports of them being seen here in the San Luis Valley?
Chupacabras, that's an interesting subject. Nick Redfern, who is a fellow researcher and a pretty good friend now, he's up there around 50 books that he's written. And one of his first books was about chupacabras. He went down to Puerto Rico in the early to mid-90s and did a complete investigation on the phenomenon with Jorge Martin, who was one of the original Puerto Rican investigators where this whole thing started back in the early 90s. It's funny, just the name Chupacabra, bloodsucker, is what it means, or goat sucker in Spanish. You know where that term came from? There was a Puerto Rican comedian that had a routine when these stories first started hitting the papers. And he said, the bloodsucker's at it again. The goat sucker is at it again, because initially it was targeting goats. And so he came up with the name Chupacabra, the goat sucker, and it stuck. So we have a stand-up comedian to blame for the term. Basically, what happened in Puerto Rico is people were reporting chickens and goats and smaller farm animals being attacked. They found, normally would find two holes in their jugular, almost like a vampire, would suck the blood, not eat the meat. There were reports of strange creatures with spikes on their back with glowing red eyes. Some of them had wings. Some of them would hop like kangaroos. They had a way of hypnotizing you. One police officer was hypnotized by one, very good report. Others were overcome by a foul odor that it was able to breathe out this foul air that knocks you out. Of course, as these stories gained momentum and started becoming covered in the newspapers, it became a little bit of a hysteria down there. And then it kind of faded out. The whole wave of activity kind of stopped. Scott Corrales wrote a book called Chupacabras. It's very, very good. It has a lot of this information in it. Nick Redfern's book is also very good. But since then, this kind of urban myth and this term has spread to South America, to Mexico, and to Texas. And in Texas, the chupacabras, generally, they look like canines with no hair, like coyotes with mange or something. And there have been some very interesting remains found of these animals. Some of them have been shot. The closest chupacabra report to the San Luis Valley that I'm aware of was on the backside of the Sandias down outside of Albuquerque. A sheep rancher down there claimed there was a bloodsucker that was preying on his sheep. He was on the eastern side of the Sandias down there, and he said that he had a cave where it lived, and he knew pretty much where it was coming and going from. And my friend Gail Stalen was the one that investigated the case. I never heard what happened at the end of it, but to my knowledge, we've never had what I consider to be bona fide chupacabra reports anywhere in Colorado. Native Americans, really, I don't really associate them with this phenomenon at all. It started in Puerto Rico. It made its bones, if you will, in Puerto Rico, and then spread to other Latin American countries, Central and South America. The Texas version, again, is, I think, different. I think there is something to it. There's something that was preying on animals. It could have been some sort of genetic experiment that got loose, possibly. That's one theory, that the government had a lab down there in the on the northeastern corner of Puerto Rico in the El Yunque Mountain area. They think that there's some sort of bio lab there and maybe this thing got loose. I really don't know. I've never personally investigated any cases. But if you talk to anybody who has, they will tell you that it's an example like Slender Man or the Black Eyed Children. is an example of internet memes that have gotten a life of their own and spread around the world. It's pretty interesting.
I think it's time for my favorite part of every podcast. I want you to tell us another story and leave us hanging for number four.
Well, since we're going to be talking about haunted sites and things that go bump in the night here in our next installment, there used to be a house on North River Road there by the Rio Grande, just on the north side, on the other side of the river in Alamosa, kind of near the golf course. And if you take the back way in to Alamosa, coming down 17 there, and you turn at the Splashland, and you come down that way, instead of turning and going into town, if you turn right and go out North River Road, about a mile out, there used to be a house there. Originally, it was the site of the original stagecoach stop. Also had a big old tree that they used to hang rustlers and bad guys. That was a hanging tree there in the yard. The house was allegedly haunted. It seems like anybody who owned the house and lived there ended up killing themselves. Quite a number of people hung themselves there so that all the lights in the ceiling, the fixtures were popped out and people were hanging themselves. I never actually saw the house. I talked to a number of people that lived in it. A number of people that were aware of the activity that went on in there. Residents told me that they would hear stagecoaches arrive in the night with the whinnying of horses, the clip-clopping of the horses, the creaking of the springs on the coach, people calling out, doors slamming, you know, tack rustling and banging around. That was one of the main things that were reported there in the yard. And then in the house, windows would be found open inexplicably. They would nail them shut and they'd still be able to open. Doors would open and close. And one night, probably one of the freakiest things that happened was the last resident, renters that lived in there. The kid was there with his girlfriend watching TV on the couch. And man, something I wouldn't want to happen to me happened to him. And we'll talk about that next time.
Great wrap-up.
Wow, I'm going to learn to be careful what I ask for. Okay, thank you. I appreciate your time. I love your stories. Well, I'm not going to say I'm in love with that last one, but I am curious to see how it ends. So there's that. Thank you so much, Christopher, and we'll look forward to podcast four.
Okay, my pleasure.
Christopher O'Brien's latest book, Stalking the Herd, is being called one of the most important books ever written, examining our relationship with cattle and how this has manifested into the modern cattle mutilation mystery. Visit his website, OurStrangePlanet.com, for so much more information, as well as purchasing his books and DVDs. Also, visit his website, UFODAP.com. That's UFODAP.com, to learn more about his camera project, helping to capture events all across the nation. SL Voices would like to thank Christopher O'Brien and his podcast sponsors for making this special multi-part series possible.
Sponsorship of the podcast you just heard was provided by
Fay Moon Wolf Designs at 122 Adams Street in Monta Vista is a delightful gallery and gift shop where you'll be greeted with soft, melodious, indigenous music as you browse their extensive and eclectic offerings. Just a glance at their display windows shows this shop is fascinating. Crow Wolf and Katie specialize in custom handmade moccasins with original burnt accents making each pair one of a kind. Moccasins range in size from tiny baby feet to adult, made with authentic techniques passed down through generations of talented native craftsmen. Each piece of jewelry, also handmade, is unique and made with care and vision. Native American and local artwork make this gallery and gift shop like nothing else in the San Luis Valley. Katie is an accomplished photographer, and her photography graces the walls and fascinates visitors at Fay Moon Wolf Designs. But there is so much more. Lovely aromatic candles handmade with non-toxic scents, rustic antler furniture, handmade leather pouches of all sizes, beautiful handcrafted gift cards, books for both children and adults, intricately carved wood pieces, and so much more. Everything at Fay Moon Wolf Designs is eco-friendly or consciously made with purpose in mind. There are beautiful dolls and other toys which support non-bullying organizations. There are toys that inspire imagination and children's books that open the doors for lively conversations. Fay Moon Wolf Designs is located at 122 Adams Street in downtown Monta Vista, Colorado, next to Nino's. More than a shop, it's an entrance into culture, learning, awe-inspiring artwork, where you'll love to shop in a welcoming and peaceful environment. Crow Wolf and Katie truly appreciate every person that walks through their doors. You can also visit their website at FayMoonWolfDesigns.com. That's FayMoonWolfDesigns.com. Or call them at 719-859-2656. That's 719-859-2656. Fay Moon Wolf Designs, inspired by Mother Earth.
The views and opinions expressed by the San Luis Valley Voices podcast guests are solely their own and do not necessarily reflect the opinions or beliefs of SL Voices, its staff, members, their respective parent company, or affiliates. The information provided is for educational, informational, or entertainment purposes only. The guests' opinions are based on information they consider reliable, but neither SL Voices nor its parent companies or affiliates warrant its completeness or accuracy. SL Voices will not be held responsible or liable in any way for the information or opinions expressed by guests of this or any other San Luis Valley Voices podcast.
We appreciate you telling your friends to listen to the podcast on slvoices.com and check out our extensive calendar of events. More listings in one location than any other website around. You can help spread the word too by joining our Facebook group, SL Voices, Your Voice in the San Luis Valley, and liking our posts on other social media outlets. Also, check out our Instagram page for behind-the-scenes looks at what we do. And please patronize our local sponsors. Remember to support the businesses here in the Valley. Most are owned and operated by your family, friends, and neighbors. We all love this area, want to see it flourish, and you can help by buying and supporting locally in your own and surrounding communities. Check back for another local podcast soon. Until then, this has been San Luis Valley Voices, a production of SL Voices, your voice in the San Luis Valley.